Good day, and welcome to the Digging into the SEC's Proposal for RIAs Regarding Investment Standards conference call. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Fred Reich. Please go ahead, sir.
Hey, Kathy. Thank you very much, and hello, everybody. Welcome to the program. This is going to be a really interesting program. It's about the SEC's proposed interpretation of the standard of care applicable to registered investment advisors. And one of the really interesting things about it is that it's an interpretation of what the rules already are from the SEC's perspective, but it's proposed. So there's at least some argument that the SEC sees everything in here as being the rule today. Nonetheless, there will be a comment period and perhaps revisions made in the future before this becomes final. But I just don't want you to walk away thinking, oh, this is all down the road. We don't have to worry about it today. With that overview, let me jump into who the speakers are. As I said, this is Fred Reich. I'm in our Los Angeles office. With me is Jim Lundy and Andrew Raby. They are in our Chicago offices. They're real securities lawyers. I mean, they do this for a living, and they represent RIAs and have for years. Also with us is Bruce Ashton, who, like me, is an ERISA attorney. Bruce is in the LA office with me, and we're pretending to be securities lawyers. Actually, we're not really pretending to be. What we're here for is to simply interject at appropriate intervals and say, okay, this is how this rule compares to the DOL standard of care, or this is how this rule applies to ERISA's, would impact RIAs under ERISA's duty of loyalty and prudent man standards. So we're going to try to give the retirement plan perspective, which interestingly, I'll give you a preview, is really in alignment with what the SEC is doing. By the way, this presentation is being recorded, and the recording will be available to everybody who registered for the program. Unfortunately, it takes us 3 or 4 business days to get that, to get the recording in place and to post it on our website. But if you wait 3 or 4 days and then you go to www.drinkerbiddle, our firm, drinkerbiddle.com, and you look under the Insights and Events tab, you'll find it. Alternatively, and even better, we're going to send everybody who registered an email with a link to that. So in 3 or 4 business days, expect to get that email. Feel free to share this presentation with others in your firm. By the way, this is actually our third presentation this year for advisors. The second one was last week, and it covered regulation best interest. That is the SEC's proposal for broker-dealers. If you were registered for that, then you received an email saying, here's the recording. If you weren't registered for it and you want to let any one of us know that you'd like to listen to it, we can send you a link to that. So then you'll have both perspectives, the SEC broker-dealer perspective on that proposal and the SEC perspective on registered investment advisors. Also, I want to mention that we maintain a blog for advisors. It's primarily for broker-dealers, but it also has information on it for RIAs because, as you know, many broker-dealers are dual registrants. If you want to go look at that or sign up to get our weekly blog articles, which are pretty short and informative, go to www.brokerdealerlaw.com. Okay, those are the preliminaries. We've gotten them out of the way now. Let me turn it over to Jim Lundy, who's going to take the lead on starting the presentation about the SEC's interpretation of the standard of care for registered investment advisors. Jim, it's over to you.
Thank you, Fred. So I'm going to just walk through at somewhat of a high level the various aspects of this guidance. To tie back to where you started, though, Fred, and just give a little background, the SEC in the initial opening of the guidance does in fact say that this release is being done for several reasons, one of which is because of the efforts made regarding Reg BI and Form CRS. They felt it appropriate to issue this guidance. But as Fred said, they state that this is to reaffirm and perhaps clarify, but I think the takeaway from that is that this is not new guidance, and it's to reaffirm and clarify certain aspects of the fiduciary duty that an investment advisor owes to its clients under Section 206 of the Advisors Act. One thing that I thought was important that they pointed out in here, Fred, and I know you and I have talked about this, and I'm sure Andrew has had discussions with clients and amongst the firm as well, and that is some of us were surprised when we learned that the fiduciary duty is not actually in that language is not in the Advisors Act anywhere. It actually is based on common law, and in particular, a case called SEC versus Capital Gains Research. It was a Supreme Court case from 1963. From that case and its interpretation, the SEC enforced the fiduciary duty under Section 206 of the Advisors Act, and obviously the RIA industry accepted that over time, and the entire industry in terms of its compliance and supervisory processes has been built up around that duty. But I just wanted to share that all by way of background. In terms of getting into the guidance, I think clarity is one of the main goals that the SEC had here, because most of what is discussed that's been out there over the years regarding the fiduciary duty of RIAs is in guidance from the Division of Investment Management. It's in FAQs. It's in case law. But as I said, it's not in the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. You can't look to a particular section of that act or a rule and see what the subparagraphs are that tell you what it means to be a fiduciary under the federal securities laws. And I think this guidance is an attempt by the SEC to do that and to put some clarity and some structure around what that term means. And in particular, there are several duties that they discuss within the overarching fiduciary duty, and the two main ones are a duty of care and a duty of loyalty. And I'll talk a little bit about both of those. Under the duty of care, there's several duties that they spell out that are the requirements to meet the duty of care that is a requirement for the fiduciary obligation of an RIA. And the first one is a duty to provide advice that is in the client's best interest. Interestingly enough, there is that term, best interest, and we've all talked about this a little bit. We talked about it last week, and I know Reg BI is not the focus of this, but the term best interest is not defined within the two-page proposed rule for Reg BI. Yet here it's discussed in the guidance, and in particular on page 10 of the guidance and in footnote 26, they talk about the various aspects of this duty to provide advice that is in the client's best interest. And what it is it's to make a reasonable inquiry into a client's financial situation, level of financial sophistication, investment experience, and investment objectives. And the advice must be personalized investment advice that is, quote unquote, suitable and in the best interest of the client based on the client's investment profile. So interestingly enough, under this duty to provide advice that is in the client's best interest, there is an embedded suitability obligation that this guidance is putting out there for RIAs. And I think, as we all know, that suitability issue is an issue that is well recognized in the broker-dealer registrant community. But the commission has never imposed a suitability obligation on RIAs. There was a proposed rule back in 1994, and this is discussed in footnote 26 of the guidance, but it was never adopted. So it could be considered guidance, but it really didn't even have the force of this guidance, because by not being adopted, essentially it was just there for a reference. In the guidance that came out just last month, it is in fact now being embedded in this duty to provide advice that is in the client's best interest. And I'll invite – Andrew is going to jump in, by the way, and talk about some of the concerns he has about the guidance when I get done with the overview, and jump in at any time, because I think we're going to get to one here in a minute. The next duty within the duty of care is a duty to seek best execution. And what they say is that means more than simply minimizing the cost, but that an advisor should consider the full range of services and costs within that. And I think what we've all seen is some regulation by enforcement, as the enforcement division has brought some best execution cases against RIAs over the last several years. And then the third duty under the duty of care is the duty to act and provide advice and monitoring over the course of the relationship. And I know Andrew's going to have some comments on this because the ongoing monitoring raises certain issues depending on the nature of the customer relationship and the nature of the RIA's particular business.
Sure. Thanks, Jim. I think the description of the ongoing monitoring is interesting in that it would apply to generally to all investment advisors, and the universe of investment advisors is pretty broad. You have the advisors who are doing traditional investment advice to individual investors. You also have registered investment advisors who advise mutual funds, private equity funds, solely advise institutions. And I think there's a question of what are your monitoring obligations if you manage a separately managed account strictly for large institutions? Are you required to touch base with them on their circumstances, or does it only apply to smaller investors who might be subject to, more likely to be subject to changed circumstances? So I think that's an interesting item that I suspect will be broached in the comments, and be interested to see where the actual rule falls there. You know, I note there is the SEC in its release notes that this obligation to monitor won't apply to the one-time sort of portfolio reviews, but I think there's a question of, does it apply if you have an agreement to meet with the client every year, and is there an obligation to check in and monitor more frequently if there is a relationship going forward? So I would expect some questions to be raised in the comments, and hopefully have that provision more fully flushed out.
So Fred, unless you or Bruce wanted to flush out any of the particular duties under the duty of care, I was going to move along to the second main duty under the elements of the fiduciary duty and the guidance, which is the duty of loyalty.
Yeah, I think, this is Fred, I think the only thing I would say is just implicit in what Andrew said is that while the regulation best interest for broker-dealers is limited to retail customers about financial transactions or strategies involving financial transactions. And when you really think about that a lot, you realize that's pretty limited. While the RIA interpretation applies to all advice to all accounts. And I think that was implicit in what Andrew said. And it's very, very broad. I don't know how it could possibly be any broader than what the SEC has said here. So that's the only thing I wanted to add.
Yeah, I think Andrew and I agree with that.
Yeah.
And it presents a significant distinction between Reg BI and this guidance in terms of the scope of the guidance and the proposed rule and how it applies in terms of the particular customer relationship. So with that, the next main element in the guidance is a duty of loyalty. The duty of loyalty doesn't have a series of duties underneath it, as was the case with the duty of care, but rather just walks through and provides guidance on various aspects of what the duty of loyalty is and how that can be established so that an RIA can satisfy their fiduciary obligations. The first is obviously something that I think is very well accepted, which is that an investment advisor cannot favor its own interests ahead of its clients. The second is that an investment advisor cannot favor certain clients over others. I think we're all familiar with those types of issues. You're talking about trade allocation and that it needs to be fair and fully disclosed. Talking about that, you know, an RIA cannot favor certain clients that may pay higher fees over other clients. Those are the issues that particular subsection of the duty of loyalty are designed to address. In the next the next aspects of the duty of loyalty have to do with conflicts and disclosure, and they require that an investment advisor avoid conflicts of interest and fully and fairly disclose conflicts of interest that do exist, and that this disclosure must be clear and detailed enough for a client to make a reasonably informed decision to consent to such conflicts and practices or to reject them. And then they go on to say that if a conflict does exist, it is not sufficient for an investment advisor to simply say that it, quote unquote, may exist. And that particular word, I know, has posed some concerns for clients. While it seems like it is wordsmithing, and I tend to, you know, from a reasonable perspective, I tend to agree and personally think that it is. However, professionally, there have been enforcement cases brought in the last 2 years where the use of that term may, when in fact a conflict did exist, have resulted in findings and charges related to that particular term and its use in form ADVs. Something that I think clients and folks participating in this audiocast should be aware of. And then in terms of the consent, the consent can be either explicit or implicit. However, the advisor may not infer or accept consent where the facts and circumstances indicate that a client does not understand the conflict or where there was not full and fair disclosure of material facts. So that's the guidance provided under the duty of loyalty. And before we move along to the next topic, based on disclosures and conflicts and how that is always a priority for you know, the registrant community and for the SEC, I fully anticipate Andrew, Fred, Bruce, you all will have some comments on that. I think the SEC is making an attempt here. I don't know if they go into enough detail and provide enough clarity for the registrant community. And I know there's some concerns with that we all have, and I'm sure the participants on the audiocast have as well. So with that, I'll turn it over to you three.
Thanks, Jim. I think that on the, you know, the use of may versus does have a conflict, I think that's long been the SEC's examination staff's view, and I think that the advisor world has long pushed back on that view. I think particularly, you know, oftentimes you'll have a newly formed advisor does its first part two of form ADV, and they list all the conflicts that they might have as they launch their business. And then that, you know, that may have, we may have those, these conflicts language stays in their brochure, and lo and behold, the SEC at some point realizes, well, you listed five conflicts that you might have. You actually had two of those, and your disclosure wasn't sufficient. So I think we've seen some frustration by advisors on the staff's view on that and that point. But my expectation is that that's going to remain an area of focus going forward, particularly if you have a conflict of interest that is not typical in the advisor world, and I think that disclosure should be full and fair, and you want to highlight it as much as possible to be able to disclose away the conflict.
Yeah, Jim and Andrew, let me jump in with a question for y'all. One thing that struck me when I read that was, you know, what is the alternative? If you can't say may, and as Andrew gave us a hypothetical, there might be five conflicts, only two of which apply to a particular investor. Can generic disclosures still be made, or do you then have to individualize the disclosures to those two investors, or to the on the two conflicts to that investor, for it to be meaningful disclosure where the consent can be deemed to be informed and therefore the conflict is permissible? I was thrown a little bit like that because I can't think of how in an ADV you could individualize it to a particular investor, yet most of the things I could think of in my head were so general that, you know, that they might suffer from the same infirmity as May does. What do you guys think?
I think one example that I've come across is that you can have an advisor that participates in a program sponsored by another entity. So you've got an independent advisor that participates in a program sponsored by Schwab or Fidelity. So that advisor might have an incentive to use Schwab or Fidelity or some other broker-dealer to clear the trades. And I think saying that we might be involved in programs that give us an incentive to use a certain broker-dealer or clearing firm is probably not enough disclosure if you actually have an agreement with that clearing firm that gives you some revenue or client referrals because of the relationship.
Yeah, and then on a similar to that would be like a 12B1 fee, where it seems like the SEC has put in a lot of its efforts on the examination side. And you know, if a ADV says we may receive 12B1 fees, and it gets it from say 20% of the funds that it commonly uses, but not the other 80%. So vis-a-vis any particular investor, they may or may not get 12B1 fees. Would you need to disclose all the ones that if we recommend any of the following funds, we receive 12B1 fees, otherwise we don't? Or what do you think about that example?
That's a good point. You know, I think that you could resolve the use of the word may if you said in certain circumstances we receive 12B1 fees from in mutual funds that we recommend to our clients.
Yeah, Fred, that's a real hot button issue, particularly with the share class self, pardon me, the 12B1 fee self-reporting initiative that came out with the due date of June 12th. And they have some specific language proposed in there that they're using as what I'll describe as a standard for firms to hold their disclosures up against. I think it's a very high standard. I think the better approach and the more reasonable approach, and I think it's an acceptable approach, is what Andrew just said, that there are in fact certain funds that we offer for which we do receive 12B1 fees. And I think that is probably striking the right balance between the problems from the SEC's perspective of the use of this term may versus this very high standard in terms of the language that we saw in the initiative release. I think the closer you are to that, great, it's not a requirement to use that language, and that language is just for perspective on the initiative. But I think Andrew's description of how best to handle this complicated issue is a really good one and a solid one for firms to consider.
This is Bruce. There's one other thing that really struck me about this disclosure issue. And I don't know if because I'm an ERISA lawyer, I'm making too much out of it, but there's a statement in the release that says, in all cases where full and fair disclosure and informed consent is insufficient, we expect an advisor to eliminate the conflict or adequately mitigate the conflict so that it can be more easily disclosed. And I was really struck by that eliminate language, and it seemed to me that is saying disclosure is required, but if you can't adequately disclose it, then you got to get rid of the conflict. And I wonder if am I making too much of that, or what are your thoughts about that?
I think that is what it says. I'll defer to Andrew to expand on. You know, the views we have on this. I think that elimination is, in terms of the guidance, I don't want to say it's new, but it's a more clear position by the SEC than I've seen in some of the cases in the guidance. I know it's accepted, but typically if it's fully and fairly disclosed, no matter how serious the conflict, the SEC is a disclosure-based regime for RIAs. And I think there's been an acceptance that if it is fully and fairly disclosed, and if the client has an appropriate understanding and consent of that, whether it be explicit or implicit, that historically that may have been accepted as reasonable. I think there were rare circumstances where it had to be completely eliminated, but, you know, I'd like to bring Andrew in on this and get his thoughts.
Yeah. You know, I've given this some thought, and I can't think of a situation where you would have an advisor would have a conflict that would be so severe that it couldn't be mitigated by the full disclosure. And I think, you know, in my experience, the more unusual and the stronger the conflict, the more robust that disclosure better be. But I guess I fail to think of a situation where you'd have to change your business practice to eliminate the conflict.
So it wouldn't be client specific. In other words, if you have a client that's less sophisticated, shall we say, where you're worried they may not understand your disclosure, disclosure would still work, you think, if it is, as you describe it, really robust disclosure?
I think you raise a good point that the disclosure that you make to an institutional investor does not need to be as detailed or explicit as the disclosure you would make to either a retail investor or the smaller, less sophisticated client.
Okay. Thank you.
Jim, back to you. Where are we on the agenda?
Get over to you. You know, ERISA, the impact that the guidance may have on providing advice to ERISA retirement plans and IRAs. You know, just to wrap it up, Fred, I'm happy to talk about the third point, which is the SEC's specific request for comments on three particular areas. So however you want to approach it is fine. That would kind of end the overview.
Let Bruce and me come in now, because I think we're on the standard of care and we're right on the heels of some of the things that you and Andrew talked about, and then we can come back to that. Bruce, why don't you take the leadership on this?
Sure. Yeah, the thing that we've sort of looked at over the last month or so is whether and how this will impact advisors who work with plans that are subject to ERISA and also to IRAs. And the thing that is somewhat striking, and I think Fred mentioned this at the very beginning, is the SEC makes it clear that the fiduciary interpretation that they're talking about here applies to all clients, which would presumably include plans and participants in plans and to IRA holders, although presumably a retail investor includes a participant and an IRA holder, but nevertheless, this would also include plans. In terms of plans, the issue that I've sort of looked at is, well, if an advisor is working with a plan, aren't they already subject to the ERISA fiduciary duty in terms of giving fiduciary investment advice? And even if you take away the new rule, as the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is apparently going to do, even if you take that away, the typical RIA model of providing advice to a plan would probably satisfy the existing rules, or let's call them the old rules under ERISA for the definition of fiduciary investment advice. And that was what's called the five-part test. And the five parts are that the advice is regarding investing in securities or other property. The advice is provided on a regular basis, and keep that one in mind because it's an important one, that the advice is given pursuant to a mutual agreement or understanding, that the advice will be the primary basis for investment decisions, and the advice is individualized based on the particular needs of the investor, the plan in this case. So assuming that the advisor is working continually with a plan, in my view, it is likely that the advice would meet the five-part test, and in particular that regular basis requirement. So in that context, because they're already a fiduciary under ERISA, they're subject to the ERISA fiduciary duties, the SEC interpretation of the RIA fiduciary requirements would not have much impact or perhaps any significant impact other than potentially the disclosure requirements under ERISA. The other thing I wanted to comment on is that the SEC interpretation seems to be, as Fred mentioned also, very similar to the ERISA standards and the so-called best interest standards that were described in what is going to be the defunct best interest contract prohibited transaction exemption. For example, the ERISA has a duty of loyalty. So does the SEC rule or interpretation. The SEC ERISA requires a prudent process to be engaged in by a fiduciary advisor. In effect, so does the SEC, because they talk about a reasonable investigation that's required and giving advice that's suitable for the client. The DOL has what amounts to best interest standard, and a requirement that the fiduciary not subordinate the client's interest to its own. As Jim mentioned, so does the SEC. The DOL and ERISA require monitoring of advice. So does the SEC rule interpretation. ERISA, a possible distinction that we talked about just a minute ago is that ERISA does prohibit conflicts, whereas the SEC requires disclosure, except in that rare situation where disclosure is not adequate. So in substance, the rules are really very similar. There are a couple of differences. One is that I think are important to keep in mind for advisors that work with plans. One of the distinctions is that ERISA and the Internal Revenue Code prohibited transaction rules require that the compensation received by an advisor be reasonable. And that means compensation that's based on the services being provided and that is within a reasonable range of compensation compared to how people are paid in the industry. The SEC interpretation does not impose a similar standard. The standard there is disclosure of the compensation. So in that respect, I think there could be a distinction between the SEC rules or interpretation and the ERISA rules. Another major difference, and perhaps even more important, is that by statute, ERISA gives fiduciaries and participants in plans a private right of action. That's not the case under the Advisors Act, and the SEC has not created a private right of action under this interpretation, or is not apparently going to impose any such requirement or attempt to impose it. The DOL and the IRS have issued a non-enforcement policy that says, well, if you're a fiduciary under our rule that's being vacated by the Fifth Circuit and you've relied on some of the exemptions that are being vacated by the Fifth Circuit, because of the vacation of those rules, you could have engaged in a prohibited transaction for the last number of months, but we're not going to try to enforce any of these rules going forward, and maybe we'll issue some new prohibited transaction exemptions on a transition basis in the future. Keep in mind that even though there is that non-enforcement policy, that doesn't prevent private actions, at least in the ERISA context. So with that, let me turn this over to Fred to fill in gaps and talk about other issues.
Sure. Thank you, Bruce. And as Bruce's comments suggested, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals has not yet entered its order vacating the fiduciary rule, the DOL's new fiduciary rule. There's a lot of rumors about why, but that's the subject of another program. I want to talk about conflicts of interest in rollovers, and I'll move pretty quickly here. But the SEC rule specifically, or the proposed interpretation, specifically applies to recommendations to take distributions and rollovers to IRAs. And if that recommendation is made, it has to be in the best interest of the investor, and it has to be loyal. And as Bruce said, there's got to be an investigation. Our view is that the most likely interpretation of that is exactly what was required under what was called BIC Light, or the level fee exception, to under the best interest standard of care, that you've got to look at the investments, the services, and the expenses in the plan, and you have to gather information about that. Then you have to gather information about the client, the investor, and then you have to think about what kind of a IRA arrangement you're going to recommend. You then compare the plan investment services and expenses to the proposed IRA investment services and expenses in light of the needs and circumstances and preferences of the participant, and you reach an informed best interest and loyal recommendation. In other words, we think an analytical process which involves an investigation and the gathering of data would be required. Also, I want to point out that that it is a conflict of interest. The SEC and the various packages of guidance that it released clearly identifies the recommendation of a rollover. If you make more in the IRA than you will from the plan, it's a conflict of interest, meaning it's got to be disclosed in your ADV. I will tell you, I haven't seen a lot of ADV disclosures about recommending plan distributions and rollovers. So I'm a little concerned that is a current position and that people are inadvertently not complying. My last comment is about the DOL non-enforcement policy and the IRS non-enforcement policy, which is that, as Ruth said, it's in place, but it only applies to the fiduciary rule, to circumstances that would have been governed by the DOL's fiduciary rule. And that is only, the DOL's fiduciary rule only applied to non-discretionary investment advice. So if you are exercising discretion, if you're managing an IRA or managing a plan, then you're still subject to, and you're a fiduciary, which as an RIA you probably are, you're still subject to the prohibited transaction rules, and there are very few, if any, exemptions. Disclosure of 12b-1 fees doesn't get you around it. Disclosure of payments from custodians doesn't get you around it. No, disclosure in that setting is, in fact, an admission of guilt. It's a very different world than people who are schooled in the securities laws would expect to find. So be very careful. The real danger is where you exercise discretion. Jim, let me kick it back to you guys now.
Thank you, Fred. So one of the things that I think we need to touch upon is the specific request for comment that the SEC includes towards the end of the RIA guidance. And, by way of context, these are going to sound a lot like what we talked about earlier with the guidance as it relates to suitability obligations being embedded in the duty to provide advice that is in the client's best interest. And by way of background, while there has been a push within the SEC and outside of the SEC for retail broker-dealers to align their standards with the fiduciary obligations of RIAs, internally at the SEC, in particular with the leadership of the Trading and Markets Division, there has been a push to try to get the fiduciary standard more clear and have it align more with the obligations of broker-dealers. And when I walk through these, it's going to sound a lot like that. And the first is that there be a federal continuing education and licensing requirement to be an SEC-registered investment advisor. Obviously, there's various certifications that RIAs can have, CFPs, CFAs, and others, but none of that is a requirement under the federal securities laws. And this, to me, sounds a lot like the FINRA series licensing, the Series 7, for example, and the ongoing education requirements required thereunder. There's also the next specific issue that the SEC posed for comment is whether RIAs should be required to deliver periodic statements to customers that, in a personalized way to a particular customer, disclose the fees and expenses. And then lastly, they throw out for comment whether RIAs should be subject to financial responsibility requirements akin to minimum levels of net capital that apply to registered broker-dealers. So those are three specific areas. Obviously, the SEC is open for comment on any issue in the guidance, but wanted to walk through those three areas because specifically two of the three have to do more with the convergence of the broker-dealer obligations under SEC and FINRA rules being applied to RIAs, which I think may have struck some people by surprise. I know it did me. So with that, Fred, I'll turn it over to you and Andrew and Bruce for any comment on these three specific items where the SEC is directly seeking comment, again, with the caveat that I think they're open to comment on any issues with the guidance.
Sure, I'll start on, I think I had one issue I thought was interesting was if you do have a federal continuing education and licensing requirement, what's the universe of personnel at the advisor that would get caught up on that? There is an exam requirement under the states for individuals who are investment advisor representatives, but if you are a federally registered investment advisor, you can rely on the federal definition of investment advisor representative, and that excludes a lot of people who don't work at more retail-focused shops. So, for instance, if you work for a federally registered investment advisor and you don't have more than five natural person clients and you don't have more than 10% of your client list as natural persons who aren't qualified clients, then you don't meet the definition of investment advisor representative. And there are lots of large advisory firms that don't have any investment advisor representatives. So I think that the contemplation of who these requirements should apply to is something that we'll look to see.
Nothing on my end, Jim.
Bruce, anything?
Nope, same here.
So we'll move on to the next points of the agenda, and I'll try to move through these, appropriately, quickly, Fred, so we leave some time for questions. And the next topic is Form CRS for RIAs. I'll start by saying this. This proposed rule related to Form CRS is the one I believe, and I think others believe, will be subject to the most changes. While it was an attempt to provide clarity to retail investors, it took them 400-some pages to do that in a proposed rule, and the three templates that they provided themselves are very, very legalese and overly technical. I think Commissioner Pivovar said facetiously that he could tell by reading those right away that they were written by securities lawyers and SEC economists, and that's not the goal here. I think one issue that will also be addressed under this is the issue regarding title reform and title confusion that has come up. Right now, the SEC has only listed the terms advisor with an E and advisor with an O, and basically said that if you are a registered broker-dealer, that you should not, that you should be prohibited from using those terms. There was discussion that this is too narrow at the open meeting. And I think the consensus among the commissioners and also among the folks like us who have been following this is that it is in fact too narrow to limit it to those two terms. So I think we can expect that to be expanded. You know, one other point on the agenda is we get ready to turn it back over to you and Bruce regarding a status report on the DOL in the states is, you know, going back to Reg BI, which, as you mentioned, Fred, we had an audio cast on about a week ago, and what impact that may have on RIAs and what impact that has with this guidance. In terms of standalone RIAs, the short answer is Reg BI has no impact. For dual registrants, of course, it does have an impact depending on how the final rule comes out. And in that regard, you know, the dual registrants are going to have to, you know, do an assessment and put some plans in place to adjust their processes and controls and policies and procedures regarding final Reg BI and also regarding this guidance. And turning back to the guidance as I get ready to wrap up and turn it back over to you two, in terms of what to do with this guidance and what this guidance means for firms, and I know we were talking about this a little bit before the call, and you know, invite Andrew to jump in here when I wrap up. You know, as you said at the start, Fred, the fiduciary duty of RIAs has long been accepted, regardless of the fact that it's not in the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. And what we have here is a set of interpretive guidance that really is a reaffirmation and in some cases a clarification of what that all means, and that's what we've been talking about throughout our audio cast here. And I think one thing that may be prudent is for, you know, the compliance leadership at firms to take a look at this, you know, break it down into some sort of matrix or usable document, and then use that as a comparison point and assess how your written supervisory procedures and any other applicable procedures compare. And do a gap analysis. And if you have gaps, put a remediation plan in place and get them addressed. I know that this is not final and we expect additional comments, so that perspective needs to be kept in mind. But for firms that want to be proactive, I think that's something that they can consider. And I think what the vast majority of the firms are going to find is that this is simply a reaffirmation and a clarification, and that there are not going to be many gaps, and that, you know, any remedial efforts should not be significant. But again, I say that as a way to be proactive, but also, you know, firms need to be mindful of the fact that while this is interpretive guidance and simply a reaffirmation and clarification, it is not final, and there may be additional comments coming in for which the SEC may then issue and update this release with further clarity. And with that, I'll turn it over to Andrew.
Sure. Yeah, I echo Jim's thoughts. I think that there is I can't think of anything that you can do today that you wouldn't be able to do if this rule went into effect as proposed. And particularly with regard to the duty of care and the duty of loyalty, I think the guidance is a pretty good roadmap for assessing your current operations with regard to your fiduciary duties under the Advisors Act.
So, Jim, is it back to me now?
It is, yeah.
Okay,
thank you.
Good. Thanks. Well, you know, Bruce and I were going to talk about where the Department of Labor is. We've already discussed that, and we were going to talk about where the states are. But the truth is there haven't been any major developments in the two states that are the furthest along towards developing a state fiduciary rule, and that is Nevada for securities and New York for life insurance and annuities. So other than to say they're working on it, I think that covers it for today, and it is a best interest fiduciary standard of care that they're working on. But let me add one thing, and then I'm going to move to the pre-submitted questions, just in terms of where we are today. I mean, where are you? What should you be doing? And I'm going to talk about this from a retirement plan IRA perspective. You know, I would adhere to the best interest standard of care and the best interest contract exemption, even though it appears to be on the way out the door, because it's a great statement, I think, of the Department of Labor's expectations. And it seems that the best interest standard of care described there can't be too different than the best interest standard of care that the SEC is talking about. And the best definition is over at the DOL. So what does that mean? Well, engage in a prudent process, which is gather the relevant information, analyze it professionally, gather information about the individual, know your customer sort of thing, and then provide a loyal, informed recommendation to the participant or the plan, and document it so you can protect yourself. Have, for example, the software that you use is one form of documentation. The reports that the software produces is another form of documentation. So, but have a documented process that reflects your professionalism, your knowledge, your resources. That's the standard of care. On the prohibited transaction or conflict of interest side, as long as your compensation is reasonable and as long as you fully disclose all sources of compensation related to that plan, participant account, or IRA, for non-discretionary investment advice, you're fine. A level fee is even better because then you don't even have to worry about those ancillary issues of disclosure and may and is a disclosure adequate. For discretionary investment management, though, and I mean any discretion, any decision you can make that isn't pre-authorized by the investor, I think you need to, for discretionary investment management, you need to talk to an attorney who understands this stuff because there's so much risk there that we don't really have time to cover today. But I'm just warning you, that's a tough area. Make sure you're doing it right, if at all. With that in mind, I mean, I think we've covered the last points. Let's go over to the pre-submitted questions, and if we have time, we'll answer at least a couple at the end of telephone questions. Jim and Andrew, you know, I think we've already covered the first question, but let's just see if there's anything you want to add. The person who sent the question and said, I am especially interested in the areas the SEC identified as subject to change for all advisors, retail or not. And I think everything we just talked about applies to all advisors, all RIAs. Do you guys agree?
I think we agree with that. And with the only caveat that is, in most respects, there's not much of a change, that it's the guidance is in line with most practitioners' traditional understanding of the fiduciary obligations.
Okay. The next question that came in was, if a registered rep is an in-plan advisor helping plan participants allocate their investments, can he or she offer rollover services? Would it be different if they were an IAR? Bruce talked about that DOL advisory opinion 2003-25A, where if somebody is a fiduciary to a plan, which the IAR would likely be, then a recommendation to take a distribution rollover to an IRA is subject to both the prohibited transaction and the fiduciary role. But assume it's a best interest recommendation, so the distribution recommendation is appropriate. Then you have the fiduciary or the prohibited transaction conflict of interest rules. If it's adequately described in the ADV, and if the compensation is reasonable, then I think the DOL and SEC, the DOL and IRS enforce non-enforcement policies will provide a large measure of protection there, even though there's a little bit of issue. But I don't see those practices stopping. What about a registered rep who says, "Oh, I'm not a of a broker dealer," says, "I'm not a fiduciary"? Well, under the proposed regulation, best interest, that a recommendation to liquidate your account, which is implicit in the recommendation to take a distribution, would also be subject to the best interest standard. So that's from the proposed securities laws. A recommendation to take a distribution for a broker-dealer who is not otherwise a fiduciary to the plan is not subject to the DOL fiduciary standard of care. However, let me point out that the definition of fiduciary, the five-part test that Bruce described, is a functional definition. It's not based on registration. So if that advisor, that registered rep of the broker-dealer, is providing ongoing, regular, personalized advice to a participant about how to invest, that is fiduciary advice. So then in that case, yes, that's a, the rep of the broker-dealer became a fiduciary to the plan, and therefore the recommendation would be subject to the 2005 advisory opinion. The next question is, do I think that BIC Lite will reemerge? I covered that in my comments. Yes, I think that same standard will apply to both, will apply under both regulation of best interest and the SEC proposal. Other than for an advisor who's already a fiduciary to a plan, though, I don't think it'll reappear under the DOL fiduciary rules, because the DOL has come out in prior guidance and said that's not a fiduciary activity if you're not already a fiduciary to the plan. Bruce, the next question is for you. What about government 403B plans that aren't subject to the DOL fiduciary rule?
Yeah, I think pretty clearly if it's an RIA or an IAR who is working with the plan or with participants in a non-ERISA 403B plan, the interpretation of the fiduciary requirement for the RIAs will have some impact to the extent that the RIA is not already complying with those requirements. And to the extent, I've actually got a few RIA clients who are, even though they're working with government plans, they're not subject to the ERISA requirements. They contractually agree to comply with those requirements nonetheless, as a way of kind of distinguishing themselves in the marketplace, I guess. But so if the RIA is already complying with the DOL rules and essentially complying with this proposed interpretation of the RIA rules, probably not much impact. But to the extent they're not complying with either one of those sets of standards, then it will have an impact. The question went on to say, would it depend on how the 403B is funded, for example, if it uses fixed annuities versus mutual funds? And I think the answer is probably it wouldn't matter if we're talking about an RIA who is also securities licensed, because they agree to give investment advice to their client, and so it would be subject, as I believe, to the RIA fiduciary standard, and would be subject to these requirements.
And then over to.
Let me just add one more thought very quickly. There are state law requirements that apply to government plans that impose fiduciary requirements, so those would obviously need to be looked at and taken into account, not to mention the NAIC model that's in the works on the best interest standard and any of these others, new state laws that are being bandied about. Okay.
Jim and Andrew, the next question, which I think we've covered a little bit, but let me just see what you want to add, which is, what do we do in the meantime? Between now and when and if this becomes applicable, what should RIAs do?
Yeah, Fred, I think as Andrew said, at its core, this guidance aligns with I think have been fairly well accepted principles underlying the fiduciary obligation by the industry and by the SEC. As I said previously, there's a caveat that they're seeking comments and that finalized guidance could be issued with some slight adjustments to the guidance. But I think at its core, this is going to be consistent with what we may see in any sort of final guidance or final rule. So I think conducting some sort of an assessment in comparable gap analysis of this guidance and the supervisory and compliance processes, and as Andrew said, even going over to the operational functions and making sure that everything aligns is prudent. To use your word, Fred, it's a prudent exercise to do that, and I think it's a proactive thing to do. And I think for most firms, there's not going to be many gaps. And so it's a worthwhile exercise if the examination staff shows up. You can document your efforts and show you took the guidance very seriously and you went through and documented this process. And if you do uncover some gaps, you just remediate them. And I think that's really the prudent approach here.
Right. And Bruce, I think we already answered the last question, so let me go to the operator. And Kathy, we'll take one or two questions. Let's see if anybody has any questions.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on the phone line will indicate when your line is open. Please state your name before posing your question. Again, press star 1 to ask a question, and we'll pause for a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal.
Let me, while we wait, Jim and Andrew, my recollection is the SEC proposal only applies to federally registered investment advisors. Is that right?
That's correct.
I think that's right. However, you know, the states oftentimes lean on the federal regulations and model their own rules on the SEC's regulations. So it wouldn't be surprising if the various states' securities regulation boards determine to adopt the whatever the SEC ends up with.
Great. Operator?
We'll take our first question. Caller, your line is open.
Yeah, this is Joe.
Hello there.
Hey, how you doing, Fred? You had mentioned that a broker-dealer, if they have enough contact with either, it sounded like a particular participant, could eventually become an ERISA fiduciary. My concern or question there is, as a plan sponsor or someone who's responsible for knowing who fiduciaries and co-fiduciaries, I can never know whether these broker-dealers are having that much contact with the person. So is it really that the broker-dealer has to have enough contact with the plan and an association with the plan, not an individual participant?
Well, the definition of fiduciary under ERISA and the DOL regulations is a functional definition, where the SEC issues rules based on registration. The DOL rules are based on the activities that are performed. If a representative of a broker-dealer is providing ongoing advice at the plan level, then in all likelihood, the fiduciary should know that that person became a fiduciary, and they should be aware of the conflicts of interest and so on. I agree with you. It's more difficult
at the participant level. What if it's only at the participant level, not at the plan level?
Well, it's got to be compensated somehow. So you can't be a fiduciary if you're not receiving compensation. Now,
good point.
People will look for compensation. If he's being compensated from other accounts for advice that's global for the participant, then yeah, even then. But in that case, it would not be the plan sponsor's responsibility, because the advisor, whether it's an IAR or a registered rep of a broker-dealer, the advisor would be selected by the participant, not by the plan. So it would not be a plan responsibility. Okay?
Yep. Great. Thank you.
Sure. Well, great. Operator, Kathy, thank you so much. And everybody else, thank you, too. It's been our pleasure to put on this program for you. Obviously, this is a process that will extend out over the next year or year and a half or even more, and we'll be back as things develop further. And Jim and Andrew, you guys did great. Thank you so much. And Bruce, you and I tagged along pretty nicely, too. Everybody, have a good day. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.